Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Illinois' pension system is underfunded by an estimated $96 billion. Now, that's a huge number. And for much of the last year, the governor's office and lawmakers in Springfield have been looking to these days in early January as an opportunity to address the situation and resolve what is the worst funded state pension system in the United States. After a lot of negotiation and hand-wringing, on Monday, a bill passed out of a House committee, though the full Illinois House did not vote on it. Now lawmakers have today to get it passed in the House and Senate and signed by Governor Quinn, or the process starts all over again with a new legislature as the debt continues to increase by the millions each day. Today on the program, we take a closer look at the past, present, and future of pensions in Illinois. We'll explore how we ever got to this point and what options exist to ensure pension obligations to state workers can be met in the years to come. In a little while, we'll hear what Governor Quinn has had to say just this morning about state pensions. In fact, he's speaking on it right now. Then we will talk with a pair of University of Illinois professors about the past, present, and future of Illinois' pension system. But we begin with an update on what's happening right now in Springfield. And joining us is Illinois Public Radio Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey. Brian, welcome to Focus.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good to have you with us. What is the latest on efforts to get a bill passed in the Illinois House?
The latest is not much is happening right now this morning. There was a lot of movement yesterday. The Illinois House Pension Committee did pass a measure, and it looks like there are simply not enough votes to get that through the floor. Both Republicans and Democrats are nervous about voting for something this consequential, this unpopular, and it just seems like they simply can't do it. The House Speaker has said all along that he supports doing something about pensions, but word is that he's not really twisting too many arms to get this particular pension bill passed, and when the House Speaker is not pushing something, it tends to stall a little bit in Springfield.
What do we know about this particular pension bill itself?
Yeah, this one, everything that tries to deal with the pensions has to keep in mind that there's a clause in the Illinois Constitution that says pension benefits for government employees shall not be diminished. It's a contractual right. And one of the big disagreements about this particular measure is that one of the legal theories out there is that in order to change pension benefits, you have to give the employee something in return. So the Illinois Senate, back in May of last year, passed legislation that would have given employees a choice. And they felt that this was a more constitutional option. That choice would have been agree to reduced pension benefits, and you'll still get access to health care, state-provided health care, after you retire. You still have to pay for it, but you would still have access to that. If you decided, well, you know, I'll just go on my own for the health care, then you could still keep your full pension benefits. And they believe that's the constitutional approach. This version does not have anything like that. It basically cuts benefits. It would require state employees, teachers, and university workers to put 2% more of their paychecks into their retirement plans. Workers will not get yearly benefit increases after they retire until they hit age 67, and current retirees would have to go 6 years without those cost of living increases. But, you know, like I said, it's not at all clear that this is the version that's going to pass. So, you know, I don't know how much time we want to spend debating the particulars of this piece of legislation.
Well, before we do leave this legislation behind, I know Representative Elaine Neckritt sponsored it. Has she shared anything about efforts to coalesce a majority around this proposed legislation?
You know, she worked with the House Republican leader, Tom Cross, on this. And, you know, the governor reportedly was making phone calls to legislators trying to gin up support for this, but it's controversial. And if, like I said earlier, if the House Speaker is not pushing it, it just may not happen. And look, even if the House did pass this, there's only about 24 hours left in the current session of the General Assembly. Then tomorrow around noon, it adjourns forever, and a brand new crop of legislators is sworn in. Everything sort of resets, and all lawmaking would have to start from scratch again. Now, they could obviously take this framework, but you're dealing with many new people. There's a very high rate of turnover. Dozens of new lawmakers are going to be starting tomorrow.
Why are Governor Quinn, Neckritt, Cross, and some others pushing so hard to get something passed today in the lame duck session? Why not leave it to the newly elected legislature to start from scratch tomorrow and take their time with it?
Well, the governor has been talking about this for a year now, and he sees this as a sort of a fiscal cliff for Illinois, if you will. I know that term has been overused a lot. It's become cliche almost, but he talks about that, you know, the business community has really been banging the drum this past year. A number of civic organizations in Chicago, big business groups, saying that, you know, the Illinois economy is really being damaged by this massive amount of debt. It's I think, almost $97 billion last time I checked, approaching $100 billion in long-term pension liability. The governor, in his remarks this morning, said we cannot allow the Illinois economy to be held hostage by political timidity. And one of the more concrete risks here are the bond rating agencies. Moody's, back in December, revised the state of Illinois' credit rating outlook from negative. It used to be stable, now it's negative. And they say that unless something is done about this pension debt, they could lower Illinois' bond ratings to junk bond status, and that would mean that it's going to be much harder for Illinois to issue bonds for things like building roads, building bridges, doing school construction. And it would make it a lot more expensive to borrow debt. If we were at junk bond status, that would mean that a lot of government pension systems, which are pretty significant investors, would not be able to invest in Illinois bonds. So there are potential economic consequences more immediately and a little more concretely for the state government.
We're talking with Illinois Public Radio State House reporter Brian Mackey about pension debt in Illinois. Brian, have any other proposals to address this pension debt found their way out of committee, or is this as far as any proposed legislation has gone so far?
No, in fact, the Senate passed a version of a pension overhaul last May, and there are five major pension systems in Illinois. One for state employees, which includes prison guards, highway workers. There's one for members of the General Assembly, one for judges, one for university employees, of which I'm a member because I'm employed by, public radio is part of the University of Illinois Springfield. And then there's also one for downstate and suburban teachers, the teachers retirement system, which is actually the biggest one. The legislation that the Senate passed would have reduced benefits for members of the state employees and the General Assembly. It didn't touch the teachers, it didn't touch the university workers, and it didn't touch the judges. The Senate passed that, like I said, back in May. Just last week, because it's been so long since they passed it, they passed a sort of a trailer piece of legislation that would have extended some of the deadlines and timelines in that bill. And this thing has languished in the House. The House sponsor says she hasn't really been working it. She hasn't really been, trying to gin up support for it. And this is part of that constitutional question I talked about. The Senate is absolutely convinced. They had their chief lawyer issue a 70-page legal document with his opinion about why this particular approach was constitutional and other approaches aren't. And I should say this constitutional issue is hugely significant in pensions, and the bond rating agencies are aware of that. I'm looking back at a document here from December, and it said, political pressures coupled with a threat of litigation may mean that any reforms enacted have only a marginal effect on liabilities. What that means is they're realistic that even if Illinois were to pass some sort of pension overhaul legislation, it's going to be challenged in the courts, and it could be years before any of those savings are actually realized.
How did we get to this point? I mean, how do you have nearly $100 billion committed to a pension system, but not budgeted for?
Yeah, well, this goes back decades, literally decades. I can't remember if it was the 40s or the 50s, but government has consistently shorted how much it's setting aside for its retirement, basically. That's how you could think of it. And now we're coming to retire, and of course, in 2008, there was a huge market downturn, and that had a very significant effect on the pension funds, if you don't pay enough in and then the market takes a dive, it's going to leave you with a huge amount of unfunded liability.
Noting that you indicated that there doesn't seem to be much movement, at least as of this morning, in the Illinois House, how late in the day could lawmakers go? When is the lame duck session officially over? When does the next session convene?
Yeah, well, I mean, that is an open question. I mean, if they're really convinced they have nothing to do, they could adjourn permanently. I think the Latin term is sine die. It means without a date. So that's the final time the gavel comes down on the podium, and that's it. Then they are done forever. Typically, though, what I have seen in some years is they could hold it open until literally minutes before they're about to swear in the new legislature tomorrow morning. The House is going to have a ceremony over at the University of Illinois Springfield, which is about 3 or 4 miles away from the Capitol. They could convene there, conceivably, but I think that's highly unlikely. The Senate is only on standby. They're not even necessarily in town. They could come in at 3 o'clock today. What the Senate president said is if the House passes any legislation they should vote on, then they could come in to vote. But, you know, you have a lot of, as I said earlier, you have a lot of lawmakers who are not going to be coming back. It's not even clear how many people would actually show up for this, you know, one last hour of session in Springfield if you've left the General Assembly and you're moving on in your life already.
That's Illinois Public Radio's Brian Mackey. Brian, thanks so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
And you're listening to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We're discussing the past, present, and future of Illinois' pension system on today's program. In just a little while, we'll hear some of the thoughts that Governor Pat Quinn had this morning about the status of pension reform efforts. First, though, I'm joined by two guests. Jeffrey Brown is a professor of finance and director of the Center for Business and Public Policy in the College of Business at the University of Illinois. Professor Brown, welcome to Focus.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you with us. And Avijit Ghosh is vice president of tech and economic development and a professor of business administration in the College of Business at the University of Illinois. Professor Ghosh, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And as always, we welcome you to the conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. What would you like to see done to address Illinois' pension issues? You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You can post comments on our Facebook page at Will Radio TV Online, or you can tweet us. You can find us on Twitter at Will Public Media. The phone numbers again are 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Gentlemen, first of all, just some general reactions from you on what you heard from Brian Mackey about what appears to be maybe a certain level of inertia in the House, at least as of this morning, for this current legislation being proposed.
Well, I would say that Brian did a nice job of summarizing the history of pensions in the state, the fact that this is really a many decades long problem, and that the solutions, therefore, by necessity, are going to be painful and politically difficult. From that standpoint, it's not altogether surprising to me to see that they're having difficulty pulling together enough votes to pass this, because really they're, you know, once you've dug a hole as deep as we have dug the hole here in Illinois, it's difficult to do this in any way that doesn't just feel like you're passing various combinations of painful reforms.
Professor Ghosh?
I think I agree with what Judge Jeff said. This cannot be solved overnight, but it needs to be solved. I think the longer we wait, the worse it becomes. So I think we need to pay attention. This is one of the biggest problems hanging over the state and definitely hanging over the university.
There have been a range of objections raised to the current legislation that passed out of committee yesterday and some general concerns about a variety of proposals that have been floated out there. Among them, Chicago area legislators want downstate and suburban schools to pay for teachers' retirement benefits just like Chicago public schools do. Other lawmakers don't want to see state employees' retirement benefits cut, and it sounds like still other lawmakers don't see it as a problem requiring immediate action. I'm curious what you both think, and I'll start with you, Professor Ghosh. Must the state's pension obligation be addressed today?
I think it needs to be addressed without delay. There's no doubt about that. Because what's happening is it's created a tremendous amount of uncertainty amongst people. Current employees, people are retiring earlier because they're worried. People are leaving the system. It's going to become difficult to recruit new people into the universities or into any kind of state employment in this state. So it needs to be addressed right now, but it needs to be addressed in a way that still maintains a good pension benefit system. It is not simply a question of reducing cost. It's a question of reducing costs in a way that still maintains a good system.
Professor Brown.
Yeah, well, so let me pick up on the last point that Avijit made, which is really, I think there's three goals here. One is we have to have a system that promotes retirement security for the workers in the system. The second is that, yes, it needs to be fiscally sustainable. And then third, any reform is going to have to be constitutional or we're sort of wasting our time. In terms of whether to address it now, I think absolutely we need to address it now. Imagine, you know, picture, if you will, an enormous cruise ship out in the middle of the ocean, a big ocean liner, and there's an iceberg or some sort of a hazard ahead. You can't shift on a dime. It takes time to turn the ship. And the analogy here is that because of the constitutional constraints, because of the human resource issues and so forth, it is going to take time for any pension reform to have a meaningful impact on the state's finances. And we don't really have much time. As you look forward, these pension obligations on a year-to-year basis are growing, not shrinking, and they're growing faster than our economy, faster than our tax base. And as Avijit pointed out, the uncertainty that this has created, both for our financial standing from the standpoint of the rating agencies, but also from the employees' perspective. You know, I serve on our recruiting committee for my department in the College of Business. We get asked questions about this. People are making decisions between whether to come to the University of Illinois, whether to stay at the University of Illinois, relative to other public and private institutions across the country. And the uncertainty is certainly not helping us in that effort.
In that context, how does Illinois' pension system compare to other states, and how do other states address this?
Yeah, so we actually had a study done by an outside benefits consulting firm to compare University of Illinois retirement system benefits to other Big Ten universities, as well as a few other institutions with whom we view ourselves as competing in the labor market. By pretty much any measure, we were at the bottom of that, particularly for the new Tier 2 workers. These are people that were hired after January 1st of 2011.
Well, let's stop there and talk about what the tiers are.
I think that's important to point out. There are two tiers now, right? One is people who joined prior to January 1, 2011, and another one for those who joined after that date. And what Jeff was mentioning, that if you look at the Tier 2, which is the one for the ones people who joined after 2011, any comparison will show that it's not comparative to our peers in any shape or form. So not only do we have to sort of take care of the problem that exists with unfunded liabilities for people who joined prior to 2011, which is called the Tier 1, we also have to rectify the Tier 2 system for the new people. And we have proposed a number of ways in which to try to rectify that and improve that without imposing a lot of additional cost to it. In fact, no additional cost to it.
Professor Brown?
Yeah, if I can just say that one important piece of this for people to remember, and I think most people are aware of this, but it is sometimes forgotten in the discussion, is that the University of Illinois and really the entire public system in the state of Illinois, people are not in the U.S. Social Security system. So the state university retirement system, state teachers and so forth, does play a dual role, which is it has to replace the benefits that most private sector workers receive from Social Security. And on top of that, it has to replace any benefits that people may have gotten from an employer-provided plan. And so one of the reasons right out of the gate that we're at a huge disadvantage relative to both our public and private sector counterparts is that most of them have a pension system which is quite comparable to ours, but it's on top of Social Security. And so it really does create a disadvantage for those hired in the last 2 years.
I understand we have some excerpts of what Governor Quinn had to say this morning. I want both of you to hear his comments, and then we'll talk about those comments. So first of all, Governor Quinn spoke to reporters just a few minutes ago, and he said the time to act on pension reform is now.
We cannot allow our state economy, the Illinois economy, to be held hostage by political timidity. We have to be bold. We have to do things that are difficult. We have to take on the challenge of our time and meet that challenge. That's really what democracy is all about. And I think it's important to get this job done. That's what the people want. They want the legislature, the General Assembly, to make sure that it meets the challenges of our time. That's what democracy is all about, meeting the challenges of our time.
There have been a number of plans floated over the last year. A number introduced in the legislature, of course, just the one passing out of committee. There was one that Brian Mackey referred to as passing last year. Governor Quinn talked a little bit about what he would be willing to support.
My view is to have a plan that does the following: erases the liability, gets us to a situation where we don't have $96 billion in liability. We have presented a number of plans that do exactly that and can do that. And I'm open-minded to anything that gets us to that point in time.
All right. So I saw both of you shaking your heads. Are you thinking it's not realistic, feasible to erase that liability, certainly quickly?
Yeah, okay. I think that's exactly right. I mean, first of all, I completely agree with the first clip that you played, which is that this is the time to act. We shouldn't allow our economy to be held hostage. Look, this is important from the standpoint of the rating agencies, from new business formation in the state, for property values, for attracting and retaining workers and so forth. But the second clip you paid of erasing the liability, terrific goal, but that's only going to happen over many decades. This is a problem that has been created over seven decades of underfunding. On an almost pretty much every single year, the legislature has failed to adequately fund pensions in this state.
Why do you think that happened? I mean, why is it that there was not a level of pressure brought to bear to say, you can't do that this year or this year or this year? And really only in recent years has there been any maybe sort of sense of political momentum to address it?
I think, frankly, I don't know, and I can't say how legislators thought that they could just get away with this for seven decades. I'm not a legislator. But I think the issue was there was always this expectation that somehow the stock market will solve all problems. That does not happen. And if you look at history, the financial realities that you have to deal with, it was an easy cost or easy payment to put aside compared to everything else. And that's what happened. Okay.
Yeah, if I can just add, I'll speculate a bit here. So first of all, this part's not speculation. We do know that Illinois, like most other public plans, is subject to a set of accounting rules that are misleading in a number of ways. They understate the true magnitude of the liability, and they fail to appropriately account for risk. And so that means that there's less pressure to fund than there otherwise would be if these things were done in a sensible way. Second of all, we do have restrictions on borrowing, but those restrictions don't apply to the pension system, so that if we just decide to underfund the pension, that sort of in the short run frees up resources for other reasons. And that's a very strong temptation to legislatures that have a short time horizon. The third thing I will say, and this one's a little bit more controversial, but this is the dark side of the non-impairment piece of the Constitution, which is, I think, for the last 70 years, if workers felt that the only way their pension was going to be secure was to have it fully funded, you would have seen enormous political movement to ensure that these things were funded. But for years, we've been told they're protected. The Constitution protects those benefits. Now, it doesn't say how they have to pay for it, but it does say they're going to get their benefit. Now, that's not to say that the unions and the workers haven't been pushing for better funding. They have. But I think we would have seen far more of that, and it would have had far more, it would have been a far more compelling argument had people essentially not been given this insurance policy of, well, look, it's constitutionally protected. So this is really the taxpayer problem, not the workers' problem.
And I think one of the issues here is, the Constitution guaranteed the benefits, but it didn't force the legislators to pay for those benefits. And what we have seen over the years also is that benefits have been increased without any concern about how that's going to be paid for.
I guess at the heart of this is a question, which is there a way to address $96 billion in underfunded pension obligations without in some way impacting the size of those benefits?
Largely no. And let me tell you what I mean by that. I've always said that I think what we need is a balanced system that has what I call shared sacrifice.
Right.
So no, we do need to make some significant changes to the system, but it cannot all be done on the backs of the workers for whom this was part of their compensation package and for whom we have been providing these constitutional guarantees. That is not to say that I am opposed to changes to the benefit system. I think we are at a point where the problem is so big and so large that it cannot be done without some changes. But I think most workers, including myself, but most other workers in the state understand that, but they just want to be treated fairly. And so if they see the state making a credible commitment to funding the pensions going forward, if they see the employer stepping up and kicking in additional funding, if they see these things taking place, then I think most of them understand that they might have to make some sacrifices themselves. What they don't want to see is this entire thing done through benefit cuts and by shifting costs to the school districts and the universities, which will ultimately just be passed through either in the form of lower future compensation or, you know, tuition increases and property tax increases.
I think what one of the things Jeff just mentioned is very important, that you have to have a fair solution. Everybody needs to have a skin in the game. The problem is too large for any one person to do it. So I think, you know, whether it's through, for example, even the unions have proposed that they're willing to pay more as a part of their contribution. I think the employers, the universities, the school districts, goes back to your question earlier about school districts, they need to pick up some of the cost. I think there has to be everybody putting in their contributions to solve the problem.
Yeah, briefly, why is it that Chicago's public schools pay for teachers' retirement benefits when other schools don't?
I think it's one of the quirks of the systems that comes up in the particle system. I don't know if there's a rational reason for doing it and how it came about. But it is true that you have a different kind of problem if the employers have no skin in the game at all. Because then they can increase their costs without any consequence. They can hire more people without any consequence of what it is going to cost to pay their benefits. So I think everybody has to be part of the whole system.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the past, present, and future of Illinois' pension system with Jeffrey Brown, professor of finance, and Avijit Ghosh, professor of business administration, both from the University of Illinois. We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we welcome questions and comments on our Facebook and Twitter pages. We're on Facebook at Will Radio TV Online. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Those phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And we will have more, including some of your calls and emails and tweets after a short break. This is Focus.
As a result of the Civil War, about one out of every three people in the South were suddenly freed from slavery. Bruce Levine writes about why the Civil War was America's second revolution and how it transformed the South and American politics in his new book, The Fall of the House of Dixie. We'll talk with Levine on the next Fresh Air.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Unitarian Universalist Church of Urbana-Champaign on the corner of Green Street and Birch in Urbana, where progressive religion has had a home for more than 150 years. More information is on the web at uucuc.org or visit on Sunday mornings before services at 9:30 or 11:15.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're taking your questions and comments about Illinois' pension system for Jeffrey Brown, professor of finance, and Avijit Ghosh, professor of business administration, both from the University of Illinois. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll start this morning with David in Urbana. Good morning, David. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Your guest brought up the matter of Social Security and the pension program. And he didn't fully develop it, although it was a useful comment. Not only are we excluded from Social Security, but if we had been working outside the university for 10 or more years and were fully vested in Social Security, our benefit payments are still reduced drastically. In my case, I get about enough out of it to pay my Medicare premiums. And obviously, if I were paid on as anyone outside the university system would be, I would be getting much more than that. Further, it happens that had we simply been in Social Security, the state would have had to pay their share of the premiums from the very beginning and all the time that we were working. What's happened is we've paid our part of the pension program, and the state has just chosen not to do so as much as anything because they're afraid to raise taxes.
All right. Thanks for the comments, Professor Brown.
Yeah, so the caller is correct that there is something called the windfall elimination provision. It's a horribly titled provision. And there's also something called a government pension offset that apply to individuals that have been covered both by the Social Security system as well as by employment in a system such as Illinois that are not covered by Social Security. There's actually a really good reason to have the windfall elimination provision. It's because without it, because of the progressivity in the benefit formula, you end up giving a little bit too high a level of benefits to this based on the actual lifetime earnings of the individual. It's a really complex topic. We could probably talk about it for a full hour. I actually have what I think is a fairly user-friendly description of this in a blog that I posted on my university blog, which is at businesspublicpolicy.com. And I would recommend one looks there. But the caller is correct that if you spend part of your career in each, there are a number of offsets that come in that reduce the benefit relative to the benefit that they normally report to you. The only other thing I'll just say is the caller is also absolutely correct that had the state been in the Social Security system, they would have had to have every year put aside 6.2% of salary into Social Security. They've not been doing that, nor have they been taking that money and putting it into the public pension system. So this is just yet another example of really the many years of fiscal irresponsibility on the side of the state. And I would say to my friends out there who are in the private sector and who are wondering why they should have to pay at all for this, I would point out that for the entire time that you've lived in the state of Illinois, even if you're not part of the public pension system, you've basically not been paying the full cost of the public services that you've received over the last seven decades. We've been the biggest part of the cost of providing public services is hiring professors and teachers and public service, public safety officers and so forth. And pensions are part of that compensation. And taxpayers haven't had to pay the full price. And so there is a fairness story that suggests that the burden of this does need to be spread across a much broader group than just public sector.
To simplify the matter as far as Social Security goes, and we have this email from Deborah who just asks this question, why is the state or why are state employees excluded from Social Security?
So historically, a lot of the public plans preceded the existence of the Social Security system, and even in the cases of Illinois where it came after, there was a long history of federalism in this country where the federal government respected state rights, and it was viewed that this was something between the state as an entity and its employees, and therefore they did not feel that they could mandate states to be part of Social Security. Now, in the early 1980s, there was an effort to bring most of the state and local workers into Social Security, but the states were given the individual decision of whether or not they wanted to do that. And Illinois is one of, a single-digit number of states that had chosen at the time to stay out of the system. I wasn't in Illinois at the time, and I'm not exactly sure the reasons why they chose to be out of it, but we're certainly not alone.
We have a comment via Twitter from Susan who says, this is her solution. Cut lawmakers pay, end per diems, transportation for them. The governor should live in the mansion by law, not by choice. I imagine that wouldn't make up the $96 billion gap.
No, you're absolutely right. Unfortunately, those would not solve the problem.
Let's go next to Janet in Champaign. Hi, Janet.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions. One is, Brian, Nick, you said there are five different systems. Are they so tightly linked that there is no such thing as one is stronger or weaker? And the second question is, currently state has no income tax on any retirement income. Could they introduce is this constitutional? I will hang up and listen.
All right, thanks for the call.
Okay.
Good questions.
Well, let me answer the first question very quickly. There are five systems, and there are some differences in how it operates, but the general principles are very much similar. There are also certain differences in their situation. Some have more unfunded liability than others, but basically they're all in the same situation right now. As regards to the second question about taxing retirement income, Illinois is one of, again, of a handful of states which don't tax retirement income. There are, of course, some states which don't tax income at all, but most states, if they tax income, they also tax retirement income. you know, both Jeff and I in the past have suggested that this is this is not a very good policy because it's an unfair policy. Because if you think about it, you might have a 75-year-old gentleman or person who is working hard to make ends meet, and you're going to tax that income. But you might have a 62-year-old retiree, and you're not going to tax that retirement income. So for the purpose of equity and fairness in a tax system, we believe that income, if income is going to be taxed, then all income should be taxed, not only one kind of income.
And I would also add, I mean, I'm trained as an economist, and from an economic efficiency standpoint, one of the good principles of any tax system is you want to have the broadest base and the lowest rate possible. And by excluding retirement income from the income tax base in the state of Illinois, that has required tax rates on everything else to be higher. So I think sort of good economic analysis would also suggest that that is a policy worth thinking
about. And there's a lot of misunderstanding about this, because quite often it's suggested that one aspect of this is that this is giving a rebate to senior citizens. It's not really giving a rebate to senior citizens. Only one kind of senior citizens benefit from this, not all. Secondly, there's often suggested that this helps keeping retirees in the state instead of them migrating out. We find no evidence that this really has that effect, that others, there's a difference between migration rates compared to other states which do tax income. And I would also add that it is we must equally be concerned about migration by working people and businesses as much as we are concerned about migration of retirees.
We were talking a little bit about taxes. Ellen in Charleston emails us, and she says in all the talk about pension reform, she says no one seems to be mentioning raising revenues. She says for decades, everyone in the state has been enjoying a tax break, in essence, as pension funds were channeled to fund other services. She says it's unfair to try to fix the problem by putting the onus on the employees who have been paying their share all along. All of Illinois must chip in to fix the problem. In other words, raise taxes.
Well, so as I just said, I agree in principle with the idea that we need to share the burden. Part of that is through the tax system. I believe that eliminating the exemption for pension income is probably the most sensible way to do that. I am not personally in favor of raising the income tax rate above the 5% that it is already, for the reason that, again, capital, labor, new business formation, these things are all very mobile. And we do not want to create an economic environment in the state of Illinois where it's just unattractive for people to live, work, and establish new businesses, because I think that will actually worsen the problem in the long run. We may have a little bit of wiggle room there, but we certainly cannot raise taxes to a rate that would be sufficient to fully fund this thing. That I think would have dire consequences for the state.
Let's take some more calls. We have Kemp on the line on a cell phone. Good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I think in all this discussion of the Illinois tax or pension problems, there's been frequent mention of the non-impairment clause of the state constitution. That theoretically in a couple of years could be repealed with a constitutional amendment, but nobody seems to want to mention that the states are also forbidden to break contracts by the United States Constitution. If you want to check that quickly, look at Section 1. At Article 1, Section 10. So it isn't just the state constitution. I would also like to point out that we can blame past legislators all we want for not doing what they should have done. We don't want to blame the electorate who kept putting these people in office and electing them to office. So the blame has to go around. And so does the burden of rectifying it. Thank you. That's all I have.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. To his latter point, that may be one argument for saying, well, you don't want to see something of this substance passed in a lame duck session. You want lawmakers that were just elected to address it.
Look, at the first of all, I agree with everything the caller said, and he's right that even if we were to somehow repeal the non-impairment clause, there are still contract provisions that govern. Now, I still believe that if that were the case, it does give you more flexibility. What we have seen is in states that are subject to contract provisions but not the non-impairment clause, they can't just go do anything, but they do have more tools at their disposal for solving the problem. On this latter question, You know, look, I'm not a political scientist. To some extent, I don't care whether it's done by the current legislature or the newly elected one. I just want us to act, and I want us to act as soon as possible.
And I think that's an important point, what he just said, is that we need action. And there's an urgent need for that action, but an action that is done in a way that's fair, that's everybody is part of the sacrifice. There has to be sacrifice right now. You can't expect nothing to change. There has to be sacrifice somehow, but everybody has to be part of that. And also I agree that there's no point in prolonging finger-pointing as to whose blame it is right now.
We have another opinion coming in from Michael, who says we need to tax all income in Illinois. He says pensions are not taxed. Too many double dippers get Social Security and an Illinois pension. Those are the comments from Michael. Thank you for that email. We go next to Paul in Urbana. Paul, good morning.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to go into the Cullerton finessing the impairment clause, but I don't know if that's really pertinent in the last couple of minutes here. He wants to hold the health plan, which I guess isn't as directly implicated in our contracts as the COLAs are. I'm glad you raised the point about the lame duck, because it just seems to me, why are we pushing it through when the next and it needs a super majority too, I would guess. So I don't understand what the motivation on the legislative part is for that. But I wanted to question the solution that I've heard that I think your two guests have offered, and it includes a migration away from a defined benefit plan, and that's you can ask the people that already migrated on their own out of SERS into their own controlling of their retirement, and most of them were absolutely devastated by the drop in the stock market.
All right. Well, I want to give our guests a chance to respond to that, because they were both shaking their head as you said that. So I'll let them do so, Professor Brown.
Yeah. So I had put out a proposal last February with Bob Rich through the Institute for Government Policy Affairs (IGPA) that had suggested we move to what we call a hybrid system, which still has an important defined benefit component. It would be smaller than the current component. And this is for new workers. These are for Tier 2 workers. And then had a defined contribution component on top of that. But we've clearly envisioned a defined contribution component that was oriented toward risk management, towards income and retirement and so forth. And this is really the model that places like Orange County, places like Rhode Island, and other states have done successfully with the support of the labor unions and so forth. So that's really – we're not talking about – especially in a world where people are not in Social Security, I would never condone just sort of tossing 100% into a kind of do-it-yourself plan. So I just wanted to clarify that.
I think that's a very important clarification, that where there is no Social Security, we would not propose a 100% defined contribution plan.
All right. So what would be the ideal, Professor Brown, in your opinion, the ideal proposal to address the $96 billion?
Sure. Well, you know, the ideal plan in the current reality of having a non-impairment clause is very different from the ideal plan if we had a clean slate. So I won't waste time talking about what the ideal plan with a clean slate would be, because it's probably not achievable. I think given the state that we're in, you know, we've laid out a number of possible reforms that we think that as a package are useful. And some of these were in the February proposal, and some were in the December proposal that Avijit and I, along with Steve Cunningham and Scott Weisbender, put out. These included things like establishing a hybrid for new workers to make the plan more attractive relative to the current Tier 2. It did involve some redistribution of the funding burden, which would have both employers and employees kick in a little bit more. We were going to improve the vesting rules for Tier 2 to make them more competitive with our peers. We were going to make some administrative changes to things like reducing this parameter called the effective rate of interest, which is currently used in the university retirement system to compute benefits under a money purchase option, which we think has been set too high in the past. And recently we've suggested giving people a voluntary opportunity to forego their automatic annual increase in retirement in exchange for a lump sum. And this would be done in a way that reflected the historical effective rate of interest, so it would save the state some money, but it would also allow individuals to diversify out of the system a little bit and to perhaps even invest in real inflation-protected securities, which are not available in the current system.
Yeah, and I would invite people to look at those proposals that we have put forward. it's too detailed now to sort of cover all of those elements in this talk, but they're all out there on the web with the IGPA, the Institute of Government and Public Affairs, and it's available on their website.
Let's go next to Jeff in Piatone. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, guys. Good topic. I'm glad you guys are bringing it up. But it's a quagmire. I don't think anything's going to get resolved. And I think we're going to be back in the same point every year for the next probably 5-6 years. I think until everybody's brought to their knees, I mean, every citizen in this state and this country, it's never going to change. The one thing you guys and everybody out there doesn't seem to understand is that the bulk of our population is starting to retire all at once. Who's going to pay for that? There's 12 pieces of pie out there, and there's 15 or 16 people that want it. What are you going to do? Somebody's going to take it somewhere. Somebody's going to be shortchanged somewhere. The problem is when you start talking about cutting things or deleting things, the first thing that comes out of their mouth is, oh, you can delete his stuff, but don't touch mine.
All right. Thanks very much for the comments. I want to give our guests a chance to respond, Professor Gosch.
Well, first of all, I hope we don't take 5 or 6 years to solve this problem. This problem needs to be solved now. It just makes it worse if we just sort of keep postponing it. You know, I think the number of retirees is an important issue. We have a lot of retirees, but I think the challenge is if you solve it in a way such that you don't motivate more people to retire early. That's been one of the problems when last year when there was another different proposal was put forward. We saw a big jump in number of people who were going to retire. And so that's a threat that we have.
Professor Brown, some of this is mathematics and demographics. We look back, you know, 20, 30 years ago, baby boomers, very big generation, were working, and they were paying the retirement benefits of the silent generation, which was a smaller generation. Now, baby boomers are retiring, and you've got a lot of Gen Xers working, and that's a much smaller generation, and they're not really going to be able to cover it. But aren't we also likely to see a flip in all of this 20, 30 years from now as baby boomers, move on, shuffle off this mortal coil, and then suddenly it's the Gen Xers retiring, and you have the larger Generation Y, the millennials, a bigger percentage of people working and smaller percentage in retirement.
I wish that were true. Unfortunately, it's not. From my work on Social Security, what we know is that what the baby boom did is it brought forward in time when we face these problems. But once the boomers retire, the problem levels out, but it doesn't reverse. And I think that's absolutely going to be true not only for Social Security, but for state and local pensions as well.
One of the phrases that you both raised before the program was this idea that this is not just a financial issue. And I found it interesting to hear that come out of the mouths of two gentlemen who teach business, you know, that are economists. And so what do you mean that it's not just a financial issue?
Well, you know, early on in the show, I said number one priority here is retirement security, and second is fiscal sustainability. Obviously, it's important. The reason we're having this conversation is we need to get our fiscal house in order. But at the end of the day, particularly for the university, you know, we compete every day for world-class talent in our university, and we're not just competing with other other state universities in the state of Illinois. We're competing with universities all over the globe. We are competing for faculty with the likes of Harvard and Stanford and other private universities. We're competing with international universities as well as publics in other states. The only way that we are going to be able to maintain a world-class university is to be able to offer a overall compensation package that is competitive. You know, we have other things to offer here. This is a great university, but at the end of the day, you have to put together a good compensation package. And both just the level of benefits, but also the degree of confidence that people have in the system is really important to that process. And we right now are sitting in the worst of all possible worlds, which is not only are we underfunded, but we've created enormous uncertainty about how we're going to resolve this. And that uncertainty creates problems for us attracting and retaining the very best people. So that's the sense in which this is a critical HR problem.
In fact, House Republican Leader Tom Cross yesterday called this pension system the worst funded in the country. He said everybody in the state knows it, everybody in the country knows it, and in fact, I suspect most people around the world now know.
So just think of it. If that is true, and which it is, how the impact it has when the university, if department head or a dean or somebody is trying to recruit a new person. And that's the most important thing to remember, that the pension system, the pension or retirement benefits are a part of a whole package of things that you use to attract people to work in a certain place.
Does that apply also to school teachers? Does it apply to state workers?
It applies to school teachers. It applies to everybody. The challenge that universities have in special is that their labor market is global, especially like a place like University of Illinois, that like the, Jeff just mentioned. We compete with universities across the world. So our faculty and staff are mobile. They can work anywhere they want. They don't need to be in Illinois. They could go to any place they want. So you have to be competitive, and you have to assure them that they are going to come to a place to work where we'll take care of their retirement security, and you're going to offer them a financial package which makes it attractive for them to come here.
I'll also just say briefly, I mean, Tom Cross is right. I just came back this last weekend from the American Economic and American Finance Association meetings out in San Diego. Universities from all over the world, that's our main recruiting place. It is amazing how often when you get into a conversation with someone at another university anywhere in the world, and one of the questions they will ask you, sometimes in jest, sometimes seriously, is, so how's that Illinois pension situation? So it is well known around the world, and particularly in higher ed, where we're out there trying to compete for talent.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Jeffrey Brown is a professor of finance and director of the Center for Business and Public Policy in the College of Business at the University of Illinois. Professor Brown, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you very much.
And Avijit Ghosh is a professor of business administration in the College of Business at the U of I. Professor Ghosh, thank you for being with us as well.
My pleasure.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's program was produced by Travis Stanzel and Lindsay Moon, with assistance today from Sean Powers. Our technical director was Kyle Mabry. He handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen.